The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a humdinger of a show for you today. Our guest is Colonel Charles Halt, along with John Hansen. They've come out with a new book called The Halt Perspective. Now, if Colonel Halt's name is familiar, you should remember him from your UFO history as the deputy base commander at RAF Woodbridge, the area where the Rendlesham Forest event took place in 1980. So really, this is kind of like when it comes to the Rendlesham Forest incident, which is probably the most important modern day UFO sighting. It's like having Jesse Marcel Sr. on the show. Now, obviously, we can't do that because Mr. Marcel has passed, but we have gotten Colonel Halt on the show. So really, this is one to really pay attention to because he was there. He experienced it firsthand, and he's going to give us the Halt perspective, along with his co-author, John Hansen. And then in part two, well, we don't let up. William Stillman joins us to talk about Under Spiritual Siege, how ghosts and demons affect us, and how to combat them. It's a humdinger of a show, as I said, and here it is, the Paranormal Podcast. The subject today is the Rendlesham Forest incident. Now, if you are not familiar, you've not been paying attention for the last, 37 years. it is really one of the great cases, particularly in modern UFO history. Many refer to it as the British Roswell. Now, many shows have been done on this, but there's a difference about this show because we have probably two of the greatest guests we could possibly have on the subject. First up is Colonel Charles Halt, retired USAF. Now, if you have read up on the Rendlesham Forest incidents whatsoever, you will know Colonel Halt was at the base that time, wrote reports on it, and really is at the center of the incident and has information, I would say, that nobody else has and knows more about it than probably anybody else knows because he was there firsthand. And then we have the privilege to be joined by his author on a recent project, The Halt Perspective, John Hansen. He is a retired police officer and has been interested in the subject of UFOs for over 20 years and has written the acclaimed and exhaustive Haunted Sky series. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And Colonel Halt, thank you for your service to the Colonel Halt, thank you for your service to the country.
Well, you're quite welcome.
So I wanted to start maybe with John, because if we have people who, for whatever reason, aren't as familiar with Rendlesham, they've heard it, but they don't recall the specifics. Can you give us just a kind of thumbnail sketch of the happenings in late December 1980 that led to all of this?
Well, I would say, to be honest, that I do say to people, well, I wasn't there.
Right.
Over the years that have followed, I have been there, and I spent an awful lot of time there speaking to civilian witnesses and people that have seen things towards the end of December 1980, not only UFO sightings, but also paranormal, paranormal sightings in and around the forest, some of which I have actually witnessed and experienced going back a number of years along with many other people. But I do feel strongly, though, that as far as the incidents that occurred over the end of December 1980, that specifically is the territory of the guys that were there. Now, over the years, there's been so many inaccuracies, and there's also been many personal attacks on Charles Halt. But things are changing. There's a new a wind in the breeze, as it were, and a lot of people are realizing that Charles Halt is actually, you know, not only providing us with a factual, truthful account, but is the guy in charge there. And as I say, something like this, I would feel happier that, that Charles Holt could give you, if you like, a thumbnail of what happened.
Absolutely.
Because it's his. What's the word we say over here? It's his barrow. It's his pigeon. It's his case, you know. And I could, obviously, I've got all the stuff in front of me. I could talk to you from my own memory of it. But, you know, I feel there's too many people, you know, have emulated the fact that they were there and probably weren't there. But I'm sure that Chuck, and it is really nice to hear on the other end of the phone today. So, yeah, he's the guy for the job.
Okay, well, Colonel Holt, tell us what happened from your perspective.
Okay, I'm going to make a very, very brief summary. Basically, events occurred that I'm very familiar with over a three-night period, starting the night of December 25th, morning of the 26th, and continuing for the next three nights. The first night, our police patrolman at Woodbridge Base thought they saw a downed aircraft. They summoned their supervisors and a crew gathered at the East Gate. We call it the East Gate. That was the back gate at Woodbridge. It was decided that with three of our policemen would go investigate. Prior to that, they confirmed that there was nothing flying. By that, I mean they talked with the people that had radar responsibility for that area, the air traffic control people, even London Heathrow, and they all said, there's nothing flying in your area. The only thing we show anywhere in here is a flight coming into Heathrow. There's nothing in your areas. So they see this, whatever it is, object appears to be in the forest. It looks like a downed aircraft with multiple lights. They go out and investigate, and exactly what happened there, I'm not sure, because they had a very unusual and frightening experience, and they were later debriefed with some drugs and hypnosis, so their memory's a little, cloudy is the best way to put it. I heard about it the following morning, and I just heard details that there was an investigation, some lights, and maybe a UFO, and I was firmly convinced there was a logical explanation and a good answer. In fact, we discussed it. I say we, the senior officers, discussed it the morning of the 26th of December at our staff meeting, and everybody, I won't say had a laugh, but they, you know, were skeptical. The following night, something happened, and I was not aware of what it was until many, many years later. The on-duty lieutenant in the police squadron, in other words, who had responsibility that night for the police squadron, had a confrontation, she and her master sergeant, and she had a nervous breakdown, or the equivalent, and she was packed up and shipped to the States. I inquired as to what happened to her, and I was told she just had a nervous breakdown. I felt badly for her, but didn't associate that with the first night. The following night, we were having a year-end get-together, the Combat Support Group, 40-some officers and their significant others. It was sort of a recognition at the end of the year. People were, you know, given a pat on the back and whatnot. We just finished the main course, and we're getting ready for dessert when the police lieutenant was on duty, came in, and said, "It's back." Of course, you know, it's back. What's back? Well, he said, "The UFO's back." Well, the base commander and I looked at each other in disbelief. Since he had to give a speech and make the presentations, I was tasked to go out and put this thing to rest. So I gathered a small group of people, five people, and we went out into the forest. And we found where the whatever it was happened the first night, supposedly a landed craft, three indentations, equal distance apart, identical indentations. There was radiation about nine times higher than background radiation. There were rub marks on the trees. But these are tall Corsica pines. And when you looked up through the tree canopy, you could see an opening, and there were broken branches on the ground as though something had come up or come down through them. While we were investigating that, and I'm scratching my head, we saw something out in the field beyond us. Lo and behold, it was a glowing object. Mm. The best way I can describe it is it looked like an eye, or something like an American football. A little larger, was glowing red, had a dark center, and appeared to be dripping something like molten metal.
Oh, my.
We watched it for a while. It actually came into the forest. It went through the trees. In other words, it was under intelligent control, whatever it was. We tried to get close. It went back out into the field, and there's a farmer's house directly across from us. We could see the glow off the windows. It was flickering like the house was on fire. We watched it for a few minutes, and suddenly it just silently exploded into five white objects, just like fireworks, and disappeared.
Wow.
While we're investigating, trying to find evidence on the ground or whatever was dripping from the object, one of my party noticed something in the sky. There were several objects to the north that were, best way I can describe them as half moons. They were moving in synchronous together and have multicolored lights on them. Hmm. While we watched them, they turned into full circles, still with multicolored lights. In the meantime, I'm calling the command post and trying to find out, get the radar people to look here, to where they see anything, and they keep telling me they didn't. I later found out that they did, but that's another story. We saw two objects to the south, and I could not discern a shape because they were very bright, like white lights. One came overhead at high speed, stopped, became motionless, and sent down the equivalent of a laser beam about 10 feet from our feet.
Wow.
We watched it in awe, standing there thinking, is this a weapon, some kind of communication, a warning? What is it? And as suddenly as it appeared, it disappeared. It just clicked like it was turned off. The other objects of the south went over Bentwaters Base and sent down similar beams. The people in the weapon storage area saw things that they couldn't describe. In fact, one of them had a 10-power scope, or excuse me, a 10-power binoculars, and he said the one object he could see was actually triangular. Well, I can't get any response out of the command post. They keep telling me nothing's there. So finally, after observing these objects for several hours, we went back to the base. That's in essence what happened. Now, there's a whole lot of story afterwards and whatnot, but that's the thumbnail sketch of what happened.
And thank you for that. Now, Colonel Holt, and John, certainly you can comment on this as well. John had mentioned how there's a lot of misinformation out there about this case. Is there anything in particular that irks you more than others? Is there one like big lie out there, in other words, or just many little lies?
Well, there's a whole lot of wannabes that have suddenly come out of the woodwork, if you know what I mean, and said I was there, and of course none of them can substantiate they were there, and the tales they tell, or how shall I say, don't fit in with what I know. But the real irksome thing, and the main reason I've spoken out, actually, I didn't want this to become public. I think you probably understand and know that. It was not career-enhancing. I did all I could to keep my tape and the memo from becoming public. But there is one thing. It's a book called Left at the East Gate, which is so full of fiction that it's ridiculous. I could go on for an hour or two with all the errors and all the lies and the, you know, disinformation that's in it. It should be a novel, not a factual book.
Well, I asked you the question and you gave me your answer. So there we have it. Now, I want to mention one thing because I think people through the lens of 2017 forget this. First of all, late 1980, pretty heavy time in the Cold War. The Cold War was pretty strong going on. And also, the base you were at was, I would think, a very important base. Can you speak to both of those things?
Well, the RAF Bentwaters was the largest tactical fighter wing in the free world at that time. There were approximately 14,000 people, counting the dependents and the civilian employees. It was comprised of RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. We had A-10 aircraft there. Our mission of the A-10 aircraft was if the Eastern Bloc countries had come west, in other words, attacked Germany, they would have to come through the Fulda Gap. And our mission was to pick up lock, stock, and barrel, the crews, support equipment, etc., move to Germany and go kill tanks and armor. So, yes, we exercised all the time. Keep in mind, there was all sorts of things going on. Solidaria was going crazy. The Chinese were, you know, bombarding Quemoy and the offshore islands. There was just a tremendous amount of tension, and we exercised all the time. It never seemed to end.
And did I hear correctly, nuclear weapons, or can you comment on that?
I don't talk about weapons. I'm sorry. That's an off-limits subject.
That's fine. I asked the question and you gave me your answer. So, John, I mean, you've done a lot of work in the UFO field, obviously, dedicating the last 20-plus years of your life to this subject. What surprised you about some of the things that you learned in your interaction with Colonel Holt?
What surprised me was, first of all, an accurate man, that he's a man that I got on well with. We've shared a beer together on more than one occasion. Unfortunately, in this business, I have to say that over the years, I've interviewed an awful lot of people, pilots, police officers, going back to the 1920s. I mean, talking about the subject generally, people should perhaps bear in mind that on the 13th of August in 1956, of course, a similar incident took place over the Bent Waters and Lake and Heath, where a number of what were described as dots or echoes were picked up on radar moving in from the East Anglian coast from the direction of Holland. Now, these formed a triangular formation, and United States Air Force jets were scrambled to intercept, and also these objects were seen on the ground. Now, those renditions are available on the internet or in other books, but I wanted to speak to the controller. I wanted to speak to the pilots, and that's what I've done. And as I say, it's important to iron out the inaccuracies, you know, with the accuracies. And I suppose that's what I've done. And what's overwhelmed me is the amount of UFO activity over East Anglia. If you go back to the 1940s, you'll see that there's a hell of a lot picked up on radar coming in over the East Anglia coast. Now, I can't say that there's a connection between that and what happened on the end of December 1980. But, you know, like Chuck Holt, at the end of the day, if you're going to talk and discuss matters like this, you know, the account has got to be truthful. And as Colonel Holt mentioned previously to you, over the last couple of years, there's been some awful lot of attempts of character assassination, not only mine, but also Charles Holt's, from other parties concerned. And it's just incredible. It's intolerable. And currently at the moment, I'm work is in progress with a second book to, at the end of the day, allow people to make up their own minds what they think. And all you can do is give people the evidence, which is what I'm actually doing. Let people make up their own mind. But I think from the Holt book, which is nearly 800 pages with 1,000 images in colour, that they'll certainly make up their own minds there. So I've rattled on so bloody much, I can't remember what the original question was.
What surprised you?
I'm a little bit say nervous because I've done this so many times, but it's such a fantastic thing to actually, you know, you've scored a hit here, because
absolutely.
I think this is about the first time I've been on line with not only with yourself but with Charles Holt, you know. So at the end of the day, he's the Rendlesham man. He's the guy that knows all about this, and as he would probably say, there's been so much BS over the years about this. And that's what infuriates me. And I did say that I don't have a problem with UFO witnesses. I've spoken to thousands over the years and covered cases in Australia, New Zealand, America, Great Britain. Where I find I have problems with is, unfortunately, with let's be honest here, many UFO researchers that have their own belief system. And as far as they're concerned, they're right, and we've seen some awful rubbish over the past few years. But it all seems to be, there seems to be a wind of change at the moment, and I know that Charles Holt feels the same, that people are realizing, you know, who the disinformation experts are, or disinformation agents, I should say, and the people that, you know, that are putting an honest account out there. I still don't know what you asked me.
That's okay. We'll take it. I think
you did.
Even though you've forgotten the question, I thought you did a really good job of answering.
Well, yeah, typical bloody policeman, you see. It's like being at court, you know, where the judge asks you a question and you give him you do give him an answer, but probably not an answer to the question that he asked you in the first place.
Well, that would make you more like a politician. But anyway, Colonel Holt.
Well, let's not go into politicians.
Yes, by no means. But Colonel Halt, was there a concern at the time? I mean, obviously, this was a sensitive base. And you have the A-10, I believe, that the Warthog, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
The question is, was there a concern that maybe this was kind of some kind of secret weapon or something from the Soviets?
I don't think so. Let me explain. The following morning, in other words, when I came back to the base, I went home. I took a shower and had something to eat. I couldn't sleep, so I went into the office. And our building had two wings. The base commander was on one side, and the wing commander was on the other side. And as I was going in, my big boss came in, the wing commander, Gordon Williams, and we met at the door. And he had overheard a lot of my conversations on the radio when I was calling the command post quite often, asking them to look at this and try and find out that and trying to get some information. And he said something to the effect that that was some night you had last night, wasn't it? And I said, yes. And I said, I made a small tape recording because I carried my little recorder with me everywhere I went.
Right.
And he said, oh, well, let me hear it. So I played the tape recording for him, and he just stood there in awe, and he said, let me have it. So I gave him the recorder, and I said, what are you going to do? This was Monday. He said, well, on Wednesday we have the 3rd Air Force staff meeting, 3rd Air Force being the commander in England, got all the commanders together and had a weekly meeting. He said, I'm going to go play it for General Baisley. I thought, uh-oh. So I nervously waited all week, and I was at the door when he came back on Wednesday from the staff meeting. And the first thing I said to him was, well, do I still have a job? And he laughed. He threw me the tape recorder. I caught it, and I said, well, what happened? He kind of chuckled again, and he said, well, I played the tape for General Baisley and his entire staff. He said they all listened intently, and at the end the general said, well, it's all credible. And William said, yes. The general turned to his staff and said, what do we do? It was silence. So the general, in his infinite wisdom, said, well, it happened off the base, so it's a British affair. Case closed. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
So I said to Williams, well, what do I do? He said, well, get with Don Moreland. Don Moreland was the liaison officer for the RAF. We called him the RAF base commander. But Don Moreland was in Wales on holiday. It was Christmas, and that was his home. And he went up to Anglesey Island for the Christmas holidays. So I couldn't get with him until several, 10 days or something later. That's why my memo was dated 10 or 12 days later.
Right.
Don Moreland came back, and I told him what had happened, all the details, and he was in shock. So he made some phone calls, and he came back to me and says, give me a memo. So I kind of cleaned it up. I didn't call it a UFO. I called it unexplained lights. It was typed in the office on a select typewriter. The only copy was a carbon manifold, in other words, a carbon paper piece, which somehow got lost. I don't know how. In fact, the interesting thing is several years later, when I wanted a copy, I had to go on the Internet. But anyhow, I had it typed. I read it. I gave it to Conrad, who was my boss. He took it to Williams. Brought it back. Apparently, Williams made a copy, unbeknownst to me. And Don Moreland sent it off to the MOD, and he also sent a copy to his liaison or his boss at 3rd Air Force. There was a liaison officer there. That's the copy that got out. And I tried to keep that from getting out. What happened there is an individual in the States, Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood, two writers who wrote a book called Clear Intent, came in under Freedom of Information Act to get a copy at Bentwaters. Well, we didn't have a copy. We really didn't. So my then boss, Jack Cochran, wrote back and said, we don't have a copy. Well, they poked around and found out that there may be one at 3rd Air Force. So they went there. And 3rd Air Force didn't have a copy, but the liaison officer did, and he shared it with 3rd Air Force then. And the then 3rd Air Force acting commander, Pete Bent, who was a personal friend of mine, called me up and said, Chuck, he said, I've got this memo of yours. I'm going to have to release it. I begged him not to. I said, please don't. If you do, your life and mine will never be the same. Don't do it. He said, I have to, and he did. Well, almost immediately thereafter, I met, back in those days, BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, German TV, Japanese TV, Radio Orwell, and the list was endless. So that's how the memo got out. There's a whole lot more to it, but that's basically how it got out. The tape got out because I made a copy. Conrad asked me to make him a copy. So I made him a copy, and he apparently made copies of that, and they were given to the big General Gabriel, the big commander in Europe, unbeknownst to me again, I found this out years later when the British released a lot of documents. But anyhow, when he moved on, he left the copy of the tape in his desk drawer. Sam Morgan came in and replaced them, found the tape, and wanted to know what it was, and I told him. Well, again, unbeknownst to me, he started playing it for people, and he gave a copy to a solicitor from Manchester named Harry Harris. Harry sold it to the Japanese for a small fortune, something like £20,000. And next thing you know, that was in public, too. So that's how the story really got out.
Wow. That,
amazing, isn't it?
It's interesting, and it's amazing, as John said, it's amazing to hear it from, excuse the expression, the horse's mouth, and that's what we're doing today on the Paranormal Podcast. We have our guests are Colonel Charles Hult and John Hansen. We're talking about the Hult perspective on the Rendlesham Forest case, and we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Now, you know, I like to think that you are listening to the best content in terms of audio content that's out there for the paranormal in the form of podcasting, in terms of on-demand audio. I like to think we do the best job. But where do you turn if you want a cornucopia of information in the video realm? Well, I'll tell you exactly where you can go for the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. It is called Gaia. Now, Gaia, if you don't know what it is, it's kind of like, you know, those big movie streaming services that are out there. We know the names. I don't have to repeat them. Well, imagine if there was a service like that, but just for the topics that we love. Well, the good news is there is, and it's called Gaia. And every week they send me over an update on what's going on, and I'm just amazed about the kind of things that are coming and are on there right now. Now, there's thousands and thousands of hours of material, but some of the latest are some of these things. Linda Moulton Howe with her new show, Truth Hunter. And this week she's going to talk about insiders revealing the alien struggle for humanity's future. And then you've got Cosmic Disclosure, hosted by David Wilcock and Corey Good. They're going to talk about deeper disclosures from William Tompkins and talking about full disclosure, which William says is akin to a consciousness renaissance. Beyond Belief is coming up with new episodes coming March 1st with, of course, the great George Norrie. And you'll have guests like Lon Milo Duquette. You'll have Lynn Buchanan, Nick Pope, John Hoag, and more. Open Minds, Regina Meredith, The Ketogenic Diet is the subject on tap. And Greg Braden with his show Missing Links will look into missing links of human evolution. I got to tell you, you got to check it out. And the best thing is, it's very, very affordable. Your first month of membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. To mine the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's GAIA.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. You've got to try it. I think that you'll love it. We've gotten great feedback from listeners so far. It's a, hey, Jim, I did it, and I love it. Because they have 5,000 years of wisdom, now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it, that's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guests are Charles Hult, Colonel Charles Hult, I should say, and John Hansen. They are the co-authors of the recent book, The Hult Perspective. And Charles Hult is one of the central figures in the Rendlesham Forest case, and we're so happy to have both Colonel Hult and John on the line. Colonel Hult, the genesis of this or the origin of this, did you have any specific thoughts at the time? Did you say, oh my God, these are extraterrestrials? I mean, what were you thinking at the time that it happened? What did you think the origin was? Or did you just say, throw up your hands and say, I have absolutely no idea?
Well, initially when I went out with the intent to, how shall I say, dispel it and to put it all to rest. That was my intent. And I was still in that frame of mind when we were looking at the indentations in the ground, although I was quite puzzled, to be very honest with you. But when the glowing object showed up, then I really got concerned. I really did. I was thinking, why did I ever get involved? Why didn't I send somebody else? This is never going to sell. Nobody's going to believe this. This is, you know, there's just no, I thought, maybe I'm seeing ball lightning, which it was not, some type of reflection. I'm trying to figure out in my mind, what could this be? And when we moved up to the edge of the forest, I mean, we were, how shall I say, highly stressed. In fact, one of the big reporters for one of the big major companies in the States did a voice stress analysis of my tape, and he said, when you guys moved up to the edge of the forest, he said, your stress level went off the chart. I said, well, I know that. You don't have to tell me that. So, yes, I was very stressed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, so at the time your thought was, you know, let's just dispel this. You weren't really thinking about, oh my God, have we been visited by extraterrestrials?
No, I was trying to think of an explanation, and I didn't know what it was, to be very honest with you. I knew there was something beyond anything I could explain.
Mm. Now, over the years, has that changed for you? In other words, you had your feelings at the time. Have your feelings about change in the sense of the origin of what happened?
Well, you know, what's really happened to me is I've lost a lot of, I won't call them friends, but a lot of people said I should never have spoken out. But the only reason I spoke out is because there was so much information in that crazy book Left at the East Gate came out full of nonsense. I felt obligated to set the record straight.
Fair enough, fair enough. John, your thoughts on the origin of this? I mean, you've studied many, many UFO cases. What are some commonalities and maybe some things that point to a solution in terms of what was happening that night? What was causing all of this?
Well, can I say, first of all, that I've looked at an awful lot of similar sightings, cases over the years. There is a commonality between what happened in the forest, as sure as what Charles Holt has just described, at so many occasions involving these objects that sometimes do leave triangular impressions in the ground. A lot of sightings like that. When I first started this, I didn't really believe in UFOs whatsoever. I'd done 30 years, near enough 30 years in the police force. And it was only my son's sighting. He's now a chief inspector. He saw something in 95, and there was no rational or logical answer for it. And that's what triggered off my interest. And over the years, I've seen an awful lot of people fall out and argue as to the source of these things. Well, unfortunately, we don't know the source, identity, or origin of these things at all. And this is perhaps why people will offer, the suggestion that they're extraterrestrial or interdimensional. My own personal feelings are that it is clear, if you look back through history, this phenomena has been with us for probably thousands or millions of the years in some shape, manner, or form. I don't think really anybody can deny that, but what it is and where it comes from. I mean, after all these years, sadly, we aren't really any closer to understanding what lies behind this. And of course, when people offer you various explanations and try and force it down the throat, they really haven't got a clue what they're talking about. Certainly what Charles has described in the forest and what has been seen all around the East Anglia coast, many sightings which have parallels with the late 1980s in Belgium, which of course the media still remain fascinated with. This is when the Air Force jets went up to try and intercept these things. Nobody's interested in what has taken place in East Anglia, but I don't say there's a fixation on the Bentwaters case, because there isn't. But, you know, there is so much else that has happened and has parallels with what was seen by Colonel Holt and his colleagues. So I would certainly defend him and my theory to hell and back and say, I don't know if it's extraterrestrial, but it's the closest description rather than anything man-made. So that's my feelings on it. And certainly when the Holt the whole perspective. I think you said prospective, but it certainly is the whole perspective.
If I said prospective, I just misspoke.
You did, yeah. And actually, we had a bit of a joke myself and Chuck, because I was going to call it Holt Who Goes There, you see. And he said that it might be all right for the Brits, but not for the States. And he was quite right, really, because it's sort of a bit gimmicky, and we certainly didn't want that. But what we both wanted was an accurate account of not only what happened there, but perhaps going back to the 1950s and 60s, because Britain is a fairly small place, but East Anglia is where all this has originated from over the years. And I don't know whether, or presumably you're not a skeptic, but I was a skeptic once, and I would have been highly embarrassed if somebody had said to me, look, we've had a UFO sighting last night, so I understand where Charles Holt is coming from. But I mean, he's had the courage to come out like so many others, and you can only say what you can say. It's just the others. There's so many others that come on board and hopefully try and get a piece of history and a piece of fame by inventing things. And both him and I have seen an awful lot of inventing things over the past 12, 18 months since the book has come out.
One thing I'll say is people ask if I'm a skeptic or a believer. I'll say I'm a skeptical believer. In other words, I believe something is going on, but I try to look at it case by case to see who is reporting it and to see how credible they are. And that's where I think somebody like Colonel Holt, you know, I take cases extremely seriously when you're police officer, a military member, and particularly people who are used to details and observation and those kind of things. I think that makes a difference and does make those cases much more, in my view at least, much more compelling. Colonel Holt, many times we hear in the UFO field discussion of the efforts of the government to cover up these cases. Now, maybe some of them are very well-meaning, kind of like yours, where you didn't really know what it was. You had a job to do at the base there and probably didn't want this distraction. I'm guessing that's, from what I gather, is kind of the way you looked at it. You wanted to be done with it, and let's move on to our job here. But some assign more nefarious kind of goals that the upper echelons of government really know what's going on, and they don't want the public to know it. In your own experience, did you ever feel that was the case, or do you just feel, did you ever feel pressured to hush up about this? What are your thoughts on that?
No, as a matter of fact, I was never, ever debriefed. The closest I ever came to being debriefed was probably Don Moreland, the liaison officer, whenever I took him the memo. I mean, he wanted all the details, and he was extremely concerned and extremely, how shall I say, curious, and he wanted to know, all the details. But I have never, never been debriefed, which is most interesting, because the three individuals that went out in the forest the first night, along with a few other people, including one wannabe, were, debriefed with drugs and hypnosis. I do know now the CIA cleanup doctor was at Bentwaters the day after, or the next day after the first event. There were all sorts of behind-the-scenes things happen. In fact, there's a real story there, probably. John and I may go into that someday, or maybe put some more details in. But people are now coming forward and say, I was drugged and hypnotized, and this happened. All kinds of strange things happened. At that time, I was very trusting. I went to the OSI. I'm sure you're familiar with who they are. That's sure. Sort of like the secret police, I guess, the best way to put it to you, that handle things that are very sensitive. And I knew the commander personally and all their officers. And I said to him, are you interested? And he told me, no, we have no interest in this, which was probably partly true, because somebody came in from the outside and did all the, how shall I say, debriefing, etc. Now, something you started to bring up a little later about East Anglia. You know, there's an awful lot of strange history there. Just north of the base is Sizewell, the big nuclear plant. and they have an untold number of sightings there.
Yeah.
There's Butley Village, which is only about a mile and a half away, which is supposed to be the home of British witchcraft. Orford Ness, the island where the lighthouse was. All kinds of classified things from Cobra Mist, you name it, took place there prior to 1980. I know that because the island was deserted. In fact, my then teenage son and a couple of his friends on a dare swam out there, which was a very dangerous thing to do because of the high currents. One night they swam out there and they walked around the island. They said there was no sign of life and nobody there. So all the earlier stuff had moved on. Then if you move on south to RAF Bodsey, that's where most of the big radar towers were during World War II and all the experimental radar. So the area has a lot of interesting history, I guess is the best way to put it. I'm firmly convinced that there's something there that attracts whatever, or it's some type of a portal, or there's some reason there's an awful lot of activity there, and I don't know what it is.
And John, you talked about the coincidence of paranormal activity and UFO activity. And it's interesting because when I started these podcasts 12 years ago, I just started as somebody that was interested in this stuff, not as an expert, and I'm still not an expert. I just ask questions. But my point was I looked at all of this stuff as very siloed. UFOs in this category and ghosts in this category and strange creatures in another category. And over the years in talking to people like both of you and in other fields of specialty, there seems to be maybe much more cross-pollination. John, have you come to that same kind of conclusion?
I have, yes. At an early stage, I think I mentioned before, I was willing to accept that UFOs, anomalous phenomena or aerial objects that couldn't easily be identified, certainly existed because I'd spoken to so many people that they only ever wanted to say, look, I don't know if they're alien, I don't know if they're man-made, all I can tell you is what I've seen. So I arrived at a situation where clearly these could not have occupants in there because that was absolutely ridiculous. But I've certainly changed my mind over the years because I've spoken to enough people that have seen what appears to be perceived occupants. I'm not saying they're alien, I'm not saying they're human. But in certainly what happened at Bentwaters was I have no confidence or as far as reports of aliens seen there, I don't believe it. And I think, like most of us, when the evidence is carefully sifted through and you interview a number of people, I really don't think that happened there. But yes, I spent an awful lot of time in Wiltshire, of course, Stonehenge, Avebury, because I couldn't understand. It seemed ridiculous that why UFOs were seen over ancient sites, energy lines, water, power stations. And of course, a lot of people think that power stations is the key, but nuclear power stations. But in my opinion, they're not, because these things appear everywhere. But I am convinced that there is an association between ancient sites and also UFOs. The $64 million question is, of course, are the sites, ancient sites, or the energy was there causing the UFOs, or are the UFOs utilizing the energy? I just don't know. But as we said, obviously there are corridors, and as Colonel Hart has said, portals. Yes, there are portals, there are areas of electromagnetic energy that attract and spill these things out. The shame of it is that it's the attitude of the media towards people like myself and towards anybody that's interested in this subject, that they're so keen to generally dismiss it. But it exists. It's here. It's always been here. And, you know, it's going to be here after we've gone. That's the sobering thing about it all.
I want to talk about the book before we close out. But first, I want to ask Colonel Holt this question. And I've asked this of experiencers of different types, whether it's UFOs or other anomalous activity. Let's say that you could go back to late December 1980, and you could push a button, and none of this would have happened to you. You wouldn't have been involved in it. I know you said you've lost friends, and it wasn't something you wanted to do. Would you push that, knowing what you know now, would you push that button and have that never happen to Colonel Charles Halt?
Definitely.
Simple answer. And I assume that's because
very fortunate to get promoted because it didn't become public knowledge. In other words, the promotion board didn't know about it they probably never did, but didn't become out until much later.
Right. Right. And that's because of the loss of friends and just getting bogged down into this and maybe diverting.
Well, I didn't lose any friends until I became public. And then people told me, shame on you. You shouldn't have done that. Why did you talk? Well, I said, there's so much nonsense out there, and they keep throwing my name around, my memos out there. I didn't release my memo. I didn't release my tape. I did all I could to keep them from becoming public.
Fair enough, fair enough. Well, John, in this book, tell people what they can expect, because it's massive, and I want to give them a picture of it so they can pick up on it.
Well, it's near enough 800 pages, and some years ago, people, are you there? I've got a lot of crackling on that. Can you still hear me?
Absolutely. Hello? Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah. Sorry about that. People used to complain to me. The first volumes I did with another publisher, volumes 1 to 6, they were 320 pages, black and white. And people wanted color. And then when I lost those volumes due to a legal problem with the last publisher, I decided to publish myself. And can I say, I think that £35 English is about $44. And most people think, oh, my God, how can you put a book up for that price? But I don't actually make any money on the books. What I am passionate about is that this stuff, it does form very important social history. And I'm pleased that Colonel Holt had gone back into the past, he would have pressed that bloody button again, because all of this ultimately is going to lead to some disclosure. But going back to the book, it's painstaking, it's accurate, it's a lot of it is comments from Charles Holt, which is for the reader conveniently put in red. There's UFO reports that people have never seen before. And it's had some. All people have got to do is go onto the internet, onto Amazon, and look at the reviews. And I think both myself and Charles Holt are pleased with the way that the book has come about, and are pleased with the people's feelings about it. But we can't get complacent. During the interim period it's been published, there are other matters that have been raised which we want to reply to. Further attacks have taken place. But, yeah, I think it's a brilliant book. But I do hope people will remember and bear in mind that, the books, and we don't make money. I've not made a penny out of any of these books at all. And I'm pleased that I've published them. So, yeah, I hope people will buy them. And of course, can I just say, that if somebody buys it in the States or Timbuktu or buys them on the moon, well, I'm not so sure about the moon, but Charles Holt and Nick Pope and myself, we will send them autographed stickers so people can put them in the book and they've got a signature. And even that has led to some silly comments and attacks on us. But That's what I want to do, and that's what he wants to do, and that's what we're going to do. So, yeah, I just hope people will enjoy the book, and I'm sure they will.
Listeners, you know that we've talked about many UFO cases. Now, imagine if we had the opportunity today to talk to Jesse Marcel Sr. about Roswell. Well, obviously, we don't have that opportunity. He's passed away. Of course, we did several years ago before his untimely passing, have a chance to talk to Jesse Marcel Jr. But I will say this, the opportunity to talk to Colonel Charles Halt and get his perspective along with John is kind of a once in a lifetime of a show opportunity to talk to somebody who was at a key event in a particular phenomenon, and particularly with UFOs in this case. So this is a remarkable opportunity. Gentlemen, I would like to thank you both for giving me that opportunity and giving our audience the opportunity to hear your perspective, the Halt perspective on this case. Wow. That was quite an interview with Charles Halt, Colonel Charles Halt, I should say. And John Hansen talking about the Rendlesham Forest incident, and thank them both for being on the show. Right after this, we'll have William Stillman on the program. He's going to talk about Under Spiritual Siege, how ghosts and demons affect us, and how to combat them right after this. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Paranormal Podcast. If you want to keep us at the top of the charts, please do three things. I'm going to do them in the order of importance. Number one, subscribe to the podcast for free. The free new episodes, you can do that via iTunes or usually whatever pod-catching software that you use, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. So make sure that you are subscribed, particularly in iTunes and the podcast app, which is on the iPhone and the iPad. That is really important because basically subscriptions drive chart results. So we really want to get as many subscribers. And guess what? Once you do that, you'll never miss an episode because you'll get a notification right on your phone or iPad that, hey, a new show is up. You better catch it out. So please subscribe. Secondly, we would ask, and usually it's in the other order, but review. Ratings are great, but reviews are better when people can read two or three sentences on why you love the show. And then, of course, please rate us with a nice 4 or 5 star review if you can. I'd appreciate it. And now back to the Paranormal Podcast. And today we're going to have a very interesting conversation with William Stillman. He's been on our programs before, and he has a recent book out called Under Spiritual Siege, How Ghosts and Demons Affect Us and How to Combat Them. And we're so glad to have him with us today. William, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jim, and thank you so much for having me back on your program. I'm really looking forward to an interesting conversation with you.
So based on that title, you say under spiritual siege. So I'll just ask you that question. Do you feel that we are under spiritual siege?
I most certainly do. And I think that it's evident to anyone who is conscious and aware of global shifts that have been occurring and how it feels as though our society or even our world is dividing into two factions, people who are narcissistic and insensitive and rather callous, and those who are pursuing that which is right and true and good and kind for being compassionate and altruistic. And I think that the people in the former faction are most vulnerable because they are the ones who tend to attract what we might call negative energies, who have a campaign of chaos and destruction. So it's furthering their insensitivity or their callousness, and it's actually a form of bullying on a whole new level that a lot of people haven't considered.
Now, when we talk about otherworldly entities, in the subtitle here, how ghosts and demons affect us and how to combat them, and we were talking a little bit before we actually started recording here, about how maybe the metaphysical community, you know, sometimes might be, and these are my words, not yours, but maybe scared off by the idea of something like demons or those kind of things. I mean, is it? Yeah, and sometimes I think there is a reluctance, you know, to talk about only the light and the good side of things. But in your view, is there a negative side as well?
Well, absolutely there is. And I think that, you know, from my vantage point, knowledge is power. And I think that despite being spiritual or despite being immersed in the metaphysical community, I think that it's terribly important that we are all aware of what it is that we're up against and what has the potential to affect those around us, including our loved ones, and potentially ourselves. And so I think that this book was written really to be a very essential and fundamental primer for the layperson to distinguish what's what and to help that individual to connect the dots in terms of what might be going on around them and how they, in fact, may be facilitating some of that through their misbehavior and misconduct.
Now in the book, you say you're a psychic, but then you go on to say, well, everybody's a psychic. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because sometimes, you know, when we talk to psychics who kind of put their shingle out as psychics, you get the sense that, oh, well, this is only something certain people can do or certain people, or to a lesser extent, maybe this is something that everybody can do, but only a few people can do it well. What is your view on all of us being psychic?
Thank you, Jim. I do believe that we are all blessed with gifts and talents, and when we are aware of those gifts and talents, they can define our vocations or our avocations. But I also believe that we are all spiritually gifted with talents, and those of us who are very sensitive or who are conscious and aware are perhaps more predisposed to tapping into that aspect of our personhood. I was an intensely, exquisitely sensitive little boy, and I write about this in the book and how I had, you know, some very unusual things happen around me that sort of transmuted into alarming, unusual things to the point where that sensitivity got blocked up and shut down for many years. So I really only began working as a psychic professionally when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. And so I'm living proof of it's never too late to really embark upon a mission of self-discovery with the idea of reclaiming or uncovering that aspect of your personhood, so long as the intention is to be of service to others. So I'm a firm believer that we all have gifts and talents. And the neat thing about being human is it's going to manifest differently in you than it does in me, because it's being filtered through this channel that is uniquely Jim and not Bill.
So how do, and you cover this in your book, this idea of how spirit communicates. How does spirit communicate?
Well, I think that the first thing we need to understand is that when we're talking about spiritual communication, we're talking about communication from spiritual energies that exist in the heavenly realm. And in the heavenly realm, there's nothing physical, it's all energetic. So no one has vocal cords, so we can't sit across from one another and chit-chat like you and I are having a conversation. And the way in which spirit communicates is going to be through a very gentle and loving manipulation of our physiology, meaning our senses, and our psychology, meaning our feelings, our emotions, and our thoughts and memories. And so there will be things that come through in ways that are very symbolic, very iconic, sometimes very cryptic. For me personally, working as a psychic medium, it's been a process of decoding these hieroglyphics that become impressed within me, such that I'm able to be effective in my role as a translator by interpreting a foreign language for others who are not yet as fluent as I am. For example, if I am shown Howdy Doody, and a lot of your listeners may not know who Howdy Doody was. He was a
I know who he is. Buffalo Bob.
He was a marionette who was on an extremely popular children's show in the 1950s and 60s. So if they show me Howdy Doody's face, I know to interpret that as someone had a reasonably happy and contented childhood. If they play for me Frank Sinatra singing I Did It My Way, I know that means a loved one was very fussy or particular, if not controlling. So it's that kind of symbolic communication that comes through in ways that might need a little bit of tweaking or deciphering in order to make sense of it.
And you've encountered ghosts and you've encountered demons. What are some of the differences in some of the things that you've experienced, especially the idea of encountering demons? I would think that would be kind of frightening.
Well, you know, I've been there, done that. And as I alluded to earlier, I had some very unpleasant experiences as a pre-adolescent with all of that. And I am at a point now where I feel very much immune and very well protected from any direct harm, because I feel as though there's nothing that they can't show me that I haven't already seen. no matter how horrific or obscene that may be. I've already lived that. And so I feel that I have some authority to be able to instruct others in how to discern what's what. When we're talking about the distinction between ghosts and demons, and in the book I do make a very clear distinguishment between the two, probably the primary way to discern the two is that ghosts are almost human. It's a half existence. It is so close to being human, but it's a degree removed. And with ghosts, because they perceive themselves as still being human, they retain all aspects of their human personality. And so you can rationalize and reason with them. And they will oftentimes listen if you can get them to focus and to pay attention and to see the reason in what it is that you're proposing for why their existence is ineffectual and why it makes more sense to move on to the heavenly realm. And I've done that. Demons are a whole other animal entirely. They are inhuman. They have a great indifference toward humanity, and they have a total agenda of chaos and destruction. They're very duplicitous in how they operate. They're very sly and insidious in how they operate. They will target the innocents, meaning children. They will prey upon and terrorize children, and that's what happened to me. And they will target people who are already predisposed to being vulnerable, people who are struggling with addictions, people who are struggling with mental illness, so that those individuals not only will not be believed, but they will continue on a downward descent into a campaign of destruction. Demons will also target those who are very wealthy, very famous, and very powerful, because those are individuals who have great influence over any number of followers. So from my position and in my experience, those are the distinctions between the two.
Well, let me ask you this. That's an interesting point that I never considered, that they would target the rich and famous. Is that, in your way of thinking, does that contribute to this insane amount of ratio of tragic deaths, drug use, and all of these tragedies involved with rock stars and so forth? I'll give you a perfect example. Michael Jackson, who tragically died several years ago. I remember telling my wife for the last, since we've been married, one of these days you're going to turn on the radio and you're going to hear he's dead at a very young age. Just had that feeling that that was going to happen. He's going to go down the road of a Jimi Hendrix or an Elvis Presley. The list goes on and on. And sure enough, it happened. I mean, is that why we see so many of these people with immense talent and popularity, fame and fortune, just seem to be doomed?
Well, I can't speak to Michael Jackson or other celebrities that have died from suicide or overdose specifically, but I think that to answer your greater question, if you look at the history of the world and some of our most heinous, brutal dictators who rose to power and who manipulated and abused that power, I think that there certainly is an argument there for them, whether consciously or unconsciously, being influenced and manipulated by some of these darker energies. I think that, again, whether you're a celebrity or not, people who struggle with addiction, it's not just the addiction. It affects all aspects of their life. It curtails their ability to be fruitful and productive, to be employed, to have stable relationships, to tend to themselves and to care for themselves. And if you look at people who are really struggling and have come through recovery, oftentimes they will talk about sensing the presence of something, seeing a shadow-shaped something. Oftentimes they will talk about hearing a voice other than their own telling them to harm themselves or to harm others. And that's the ultimate goal of demonic energies. We tend to think of demonic possession as something as spectacular as what we've seen in The Exorcist. But that's a very Hollywood romanticized version of the extent to which those events can become exaggerated. I think it's much more delicate and insidious than that. And I think it is a very gradual process that before you know it, you can't see the forest for the trees. If you look at interviews with mass murderers or people who snapped and took out their entire families, oftentimes they will say, "I heard a voice telling me to do this."
Now here's the question. You kind of touched on this earlier. Many people would say, yeah, there's a voice. They're schizophrenic and they're mentally ill. I mean, what would you say to that kind of common reply to that?
Right. Well, I think that's a very interesting debate to be had. And I do bring this up in the book. You know, are we talking about mental illness, or is all of mental illness really a form of demonic possession, particularly if there are harmful thoughts or harmful actions associated with it? I think that there's going to need to be a merging of the two camps of thought at some point in the future as we're moving forward, and we're seeing more and more of this, particularly among our young people, and the spike in overdose and especially heroin-related overdoses.
Now, is there anything that we can avoid that might make us less susceptible to demons? I mean, I know, for example, yes. some people say don't use a Ouija board, for example. That's a common one. What are some of the right. things or activities, if there are any, that we can avoid that might bring on vulnerabilities?
Yes, well, simply clean up your act. I mean, really enter into a period of self-assessment and self-reflection and look at ways in which you can become an improved version of your old self in being of service to other people around you, in aspiring to be kinder and more compassionate. You know, the more you generate positive thought, positive energy, positive actions, the less opportunity there is for negative energy to take hold. And this is precisely what I tell people when I facilitate clearing or cleansing of a home environment is, you know, you can either feed it or you can starve it. And if you have someone who is toxic in the house, if you persist in using pornography, if you won't stop watching horror movies or zombie movies, then I can't help you. You know, there has to be an initiative to create and nurture and foster positive change. And the reason why I wrote this book was because I was coming repeatedly across people who were taking it upon themselves to attempt their own process of clearing house based upon what they've seen in horror movies or TV shows. And they were actively engaging with these energies, and they are the last people who should be doing that because they're in the epicenter of the chaos.
Now that's very interesting, because we've talked about this before, you know, the preponderance of paranormal TV shows. And certainly we've interviewed people from some of those shows, and they seem very, very sincere in what they're doing. It does seem, though, that sometimes you get people who are watching these programs who kind of like, it's like, don't do this. This is a don't attempt this at home kind of thing. And they'll go in and just like one might, right. You know, I use the analogy bowling, for example. Bowling, you know, when I was growing up was extremely popular. People would have it, and there still are, but it used to really be popular. People have leagues and they'd all have the same shirts and all this stuff. And now it's kind of like you've seen kind of that mentality put into paranormal studies and things like ghost hunting, where people will get the shirts and they have a team. Now, granted, in some cases, I will say that they've done nothing but watch a television show. So you're telling me that that is not necessarily harmless fun, that there might be some danger in that.
Well, sometimes saying don't try this at home is akin to going on a picnic and sprinkling sugar everywhere and not expecting ants to show up. And so I think that there are some people who are not terribly well educated when it comes to this material, who, again, are very impressionable and feel as though this is something that they should investigate on their own. And they're actively making efforts to communicate with, to record audially or visual or on video, these energies. And if there is activity in their immediate home environment, they're involved. They're a part of it. And what I can also tell you, Jim, is that in every instance where I have investigated a quote-unquote haunting situation and have determined that the source is demonic energy, mm-hmm. there has always been abuse and addiction in that household. So these are folks who, in my opinion and in my experience, have absolutely no business attempting to engage with whatever energy is there, because that's what it wants. And oftentimes, these energies will masquerade as a loved one who has passed on and is in spirit. So people will say, oh, I thought it was my father trying to contact me, or I thought it was my sister, when in fact it is something that is a mimic.
Yeah, that's a concern to me. That's the one thing that is a concern, whether you're talking to a psychic or you're getting your own feeling, or, you know, when somebody talks about something like a Ouija board, it's like, well, how do we know what it is actually what it says it is? I mean, how do we know? Are there telltale signs that we're being led down the primrose path?
Right. Well, I'll tell you how we know. I don't do anything without spending time in prayer and meditation, not only to protect myself, but to bless the immediate environment in which I will be working. And I also say a blessing with a client or an audience if I'm doing an event. That is foremost of utmost importance. I do need to let people know also that people who are psychics or psychic mediums are not turned on 24/7, like television may give the impression that we are. It is a deliberate process that I enter into through prayer and meditation. Now, to address your question, how do you know the difference between what's authentic and what's inauthentic? The demon energies themselves are inauthentic. They have a destructive mission, remember. And so whatever it is that they manifest that is an imitation or a mimic will also be imperfect. And so they will never replicate a loved one exactly. They will always get something wrong. They'll get the eye color wrong. They'll get the tone of voice wrong. Or someone would say, well, I thought it was my grandfather, but then I don't think my grandfather would say something like that. If there's an apparition of the loved one, that the apparition may not be fully formed. It may be missing a body part, such as a hand, for example. The gait, if it's in motion, will be off. And so there will always be something inauthentic about that. I also want to reinforce that if our loved ones are where they should be, having made the transition to the heavenly realm, then a good rule of thumb to abide by is to remember that a loving presence will only ever be a loving presence. What that means is that a loving presence, one that exists in the heavenly realm, would never do anything to incite harm, chaos, fear, or anxiety of any kind. That's not a loving presence. That's a presence with its own agenda.
So in terms of protection, I mean, you said that to clean up our act and anything like that. Any other ideas on how to have proper protection? I know you cover it in the book.
Yes. Well, you know, you can do all kinds of things if you wish to, but bottom line is nothing trumps prayer. Nothing trumps reclaiming, rediscovering, or strengthening that direct line of communication with God.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I want to make a point here. And some people may take issue with this, but we've been doing these shows through 2005, or since 2005. And a lot of times when I mention God, people, I think, kind of look askance. God, what does God have to do with all this spiritual stuff? And I'm just like, wait a minute. In fact, I had somebody, a very nice guy, who said he was a paranormal investigator who didn't believe in God. And I didn't get that. It's perfectly his right, but I didn't get that. Why do you think there's such a reluctance to talk about things like God and prayer and those kind of things, whether it be sometimes in metaphysics, it'd be sometimes in paranormal studies? Why do you think people shy away from that?
I'm not sure exactly why that is, Jim, unless there's some sort of hidden agenda there where those people are also being slowly but surely targeted themselves. I'm finding that I'm in my 50s, so I'm finding that a lot of younger people choose not to think about or use the term God, but they will talk about universe. They will talk about higher power, and I'm perfectly okay with that. I don't care if you call it, you know, God or Allah or higher power or Wonder Woman, whatever you want to call it. As long as you are paying reverence to the source of our creation, I think there's extraordinary power in that for championing this campaign of goodness.
So if people want to connect to everything that you do and find this book, how can they go about that, William?
Thank you. They could simply go to my website, Jim, which is williamstillman.com. Stillman is spelled S-T-I-L-L-M-A-N, just as you would think it is. williamstillman.com. And they can learn all about me. I've written also books about autism and several books about autism and a spiritual connection. And if people wish to, if they are on Facebook, there's an icon in the upper left corner of the homepage of my website. People can click on that and follow me on Facebook. Every morning I put up an original inspirational quote that I receive in my prayer and meditation time. And I've got over 1,300 of them now, and each is unique. And it might be a nice way to start the day.
One thing I want to ask you about that I noticed in your book, and I neglected to mention earlier, but I think it's kind of cool. You think one important thing in your life in this regard to protect yourself and to have a good state of mind and so forth, I guess, is to practice random acts of kindness. Why is that important?
Mm-hmm. I think as human beings, we are naturally predisposed to being very egocentric. And we've had to from infancy as a matter of survival. But I think there's a point in all of our lives at which we need to create a shift away from that toward being selfless instead of selfish. And that was really a turning point for me. As I said, I became blocked up for decades of my life and was, I think, insensitive and lacking in the compassion that I feel I'm working toward possessing now. And so I'd like to think that I'm living proof of the transformation that anyone can create within themselves. None of us is resigned to existing in old patterns in the way that we think people are accustomed to perceiving us. And we are all in a position to break those old patterns or cycles of behavior or misconduct in an effort to become improved versions of our old selves and aspire to all that is right and true and good and kind. And I think that's why we're here. I think if there's a secret meaning to life, it is to take all that you know to be true of yourself, good, bad, and indifferent, all that you have been, all that you are presently, all that you are becoming, and employ it to be of service to others. And then I think you're home free.
Thank you, William Stillman, for your insight today on the program.
It's been a delight to have a conversation with you, Jim, and I very much appreciate you having me back.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this show as much as I did. Wow, this was really a pretty powerful show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope that you will subscribe to the show so you never miss another episode. You review the show, and you rate it wherever you may listen. We thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.